Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What are the morals of your children's favorite stories? Plenty of best-selling authors slip in parent-approved messages about sharing or preserving tradition or respecting authority. But other writers, from Sid Hoff to Dr. Seuss, have penned books with more revolutionary intentions, hoping to encourage young minds to think freely, question authority, and fight against the dominant culture. These works fascinate English professor Philip Nell. He is director of the program in children's literature at Kansas State University. Along with Julia L. Mickenberg, he is the editor of Tales for Little Rebels, a collection of radical children's literature. Philip, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
How does radical literature tend to differ from the standard fare?
Well, one way it differs is that it has an explicit political agenda, you know, whether that agenda is about respecting difference, whether that agenda is about fighting fascism, as is the case in some of these stories. That's one way that it differs. And I mean, truly radical children's literature tries to get at the roots of a cause and really be revolutionary about it. And to be fair, our own anthology, though it is called A Collection of Radical Children's Literature, really runs the spectrum on the left from the merely liberal to the truly radical.
Yeah. And what's interesting is even on the right, there really has been a long history in American literature for children of injecting political or at least spiritual and cultural themes into this material, beginning with the Puritans.
Yeah, beginning with the Puritans and moving up to the Left Behind books for kids today. New England Primer published in the 17th century has an alphabet that begins, A, in Adam's fall, we sinned all. And then next to an image of a Bible, thy life to mend, this book attend. So, you know, and explicitly be religious and go to church and pray and all will be well, but in the form of an alphabet book. Then, of course, the Left Behind books are the contemporary manifestation of certainly the religious right, at least, producing works for children.
Yeah, and Lynn Cheney, the wife of the vice president, has done an alphabet book.
Yep, Lynn Cheney has. There are also those books, Help Mom, Hollywood's in My Hamper, and, you know, Help Mom, There Are Liberals Under the Bed, which read to me as parody, but they're not actually intended as parody. They're really about the pernicious influence of the left, you know, at least according to the author of them.
And in some cases, there are also things that are not nearly so overt, but in modern times, many, if not most, children's books do seem to reinforce sort of broad cultural norms. For example, the benefits of industrialization with Mike Mulligan and his steam shovel.
Sure. Yeah, and Virginia Lee Burton is an interesting case because I think politically she's actually on the left. But, Mike Mulligan and his steam shovel certainly could be read that way. And you raise a good point, too, which is that all literature for children is political, whether it reinforces the status quo, whether it's coming from the right or whether it's coming from the left. It's political because there's a message there, and you know that message is going out to some of the most vulnerable people. Really, I mean the children who are, at the mercy of others, but also whose minds are still in the process of being formed. So it's all political.
How often are these works, these radical works, well written and engaging as compared with whatever commercial books they might have been competing with?
Well, you know, I think a myth of political children's literature, or really sort of literature on the left in general, a myth is that, it's not very good, it's overly didactic, it's not any fun. I don't think that's true. I do think that some of the works that we've included in here are very aggressive and quite didactic, but there's plenty of fun stuff as well. I mean, probably one of the best-known liberal writers of children's literature is Dr. Seuss, who is an immensely entertaining storyteller. We include an early version of his story, The Sneetches, in our collection, and he wrote The Sneetches as a protest against discrimination. It was particularly a protest against anti-Semitism, but it really works as an anti-discrimination story of any sort. You know, there's these bird-like creatures with stars in their bellies, and then the bird-like creatures without, and then by the end of the story, they learn that sneetches are sneetches, and no kind of sneetches the best on the beaches. I think there's plenty of left-leaning children's literature out there that is very well written and is very good and even quite funny.
The line that you have in the book is that we think about Dr. Seuss teaching children how to read, but in many cases he's helping to teach them how to think.
Yeah, absolutely. And he wrote, after the Second World War, a series of explicitly political books where he really was trying to change people's minds. And he gets involved in politics in particular during the Second World War when he does over 400 editorial cartoons for the Popular Front New York newspaper, PM. And that really teaches him to be political in his work. And then after the war, you know, you get works like The Sneetches, you get works like Horton Hears a Who, which can be read in a number of ways, but I think one way is about the power of democracy and participatory democracy. The Whos are not going to be saved unless all of them speak up, all of them take a role in speaking up for themselves. And it was certainly read when it was published being as a book about the rights of minorities in particular, because Horton is, of course, protecting a group who are vulnerable because of their lack of power. They're people, you know, they're deserving of rights, but they lack the power to protect themselves. So, yeah, he was very political in some of his works, and intentionally. And I could talk a lot about Dr. Seuss. I've written a couple of books on him.
Well, I know you have. Well, I'm interested, you know, the refrain of Horton Hears a Who is a person's a person no matter how small. And,
right.
Of course, when the movie came out, a lot of right-to-life groups really embraced this as something that communicated
right.
their message. How would Dr. Seuss have felt about that?
He wouldn't have liked it. When he was alive, in fact, a pro-life group was using that slogan on its stationery, and he threatened to sue them unless they stopped. He did not feel that was an appropriate interpretation of his book and did not support that cause. So he would have considered that a misreading of his work. But it is frequently invoked as being, you know, a person's person no matter how small, and people see the small as being referring to a fetus. But it's really not. It's really about power. That's what it's about. And, one of the issues when you write an allegory, as Seuss does, is that people will interpret it in ways other than you intend, and that's what's happened with his book. But not something he would have liked.
What's amazing about Dr. Seuss and the reach that he's had is that even, I would imagine that he has won over a lot of audiences, a lot of parents, mm-hmm. who might not have agreed explicitly with his views, but are sort of captivated by the illustrations and charmed by the text, and they
right.
figure it's just a kid's book.
Right, and I mean, his style of verse keeps you reading, the rhythms keep moving you along. He's very inventive. The crazy creatures that he invents and the plots that he comes up with. I mean, the story comes first in Seuss. So you read Seuss, you enjoy the narrative, and then there's a lesson along with that, but you may not even be noticing at the time. Although I think a lot of his politically progressive messages became mainstream over time. You know, so The Lorax, when it was published in 1971, was actually seen as fairly aggressive in its stance on protecting the environment, and actually is a bit too propagandistic. I think now people read that, and there's no argument with that, especially now with our climate and the crisis that it's in. So I think part of it, too, is that what was once liberal is now more accepted, you know, even in a country that is, I think, basically a conservative country.
Do you have a hard time reconciling this sort of left-leaning environmental activist Dr. Seuss with the anti-Japanese propaganda that he created during the Second World War?
We have an hour program. How long do you want to talk about
this? It's NPR, absolutely.
The thing to recognize with Seuss's use of caricature is that it changes over time. So in the 1920s, for example, his magazine cartoons feature caricatures of African Americans. But by the Second World War, his cartoons are advocating equal treatment for African Americans, that they should not be denied participation in, war jobs, for example. We need their labor as well. They should not be discriminated against. I mean, he's anti-Jim Crow, you know, he's anti-poll tax. And the same is true of his caricatures and his treatment of the Japanese, that, in fact, even during the war, his attitude evolves there. He wrote a military training film called Your Job in Japan, which General MacArthur considered too sympathetic to the Japanese and so prevented it from being shown. He and his wife Helen co-wrote a film it's called Design for Death, and it was about how the Japanese are victims of centuries of class dictatorship. And Horton Hears a Who was actually written after a visit to Japan, and it's actually dedicated to a Kyoto University professor, Mitsugi Nakamura, who he met over there and who he corresponded with throughout his life. So, I mean, one way to read Horton Hears a Who is about the Japanese embrace of participatory democracy after the war, which he saw as really a success over there. So I think the way to think about Susan's stereotypes is that, generally speaking, his attitudes evolved over time, and they changed, which I think is a powerful thing for people to be aware of, that learned prejudice can be unlearned, that people can change. So that's a long answer to a short question.
That's great.
Hope that wasn't too long.
No, it's fine. Philip Nell is my guest. He's director of the program in children's literature at Kansas State University and the co-editor of Tales for Little Rebels, a collection of radical children's literature. So you have Sid Hoff, who many parents know as the guy who wrote Danny and the Dinosaur.
Right.
He also, though, wrote for children under a pseudonym.
Right. He his first children's book was written under the name A. Redfield. And ponder that pseudonym for a moment. Redfield. I wonder why Red. He used that pseudonym when he published his cartoons in New Masses and when he published his cartoons in The Daily Worker. And Mr. His, A Children's Story for Anybody, is his very first children's book. And it is about how the people of his town, who are, of course, oppressed by this greedy capitalist tyrant, organize and drive out the greedy capitalist tyrant and make it into our town. But yeah, Sid Hoff has a long history on the left that almost nobody knows about.
It's funny how many of these characters, these, you know, socialist and communist writers created. It was always a fat cat. It was always a sort of a white fat man.
I know.
And that always represents, you know, an overabundance of greed and personal wealth.
I know, which is sort of troubling today when, you know, I think
most of America looks that way.
Well, yeah, I mean, obesity is more likely to be a sign of actually impoverishment, you know, that you're eating the wrong kind of food. At the time, the fat cat stereotype is the one that is perpetuated, certainly, for the greedy, the wealthy, the powerful. They have plenty to eat, and we have not enough. So, yeah.
So was Sid Hoff aware of the fact that using his pseudonym for more mainstream literature would never sell and he would be connected, or did he just decide that he was ready to start using his own name?
Well, he abandons the A. Redfield name sometime in the 40s, I think the early 40s. I haven't seen anything after it on that. He didn't want anybody to know about it. I actually corresponded with him and talked to him before he passed away. And he was actually worried that people would find out about this side of his career. You know, he said, if people learn about that, I'll never work again. If people learn that he was affiliated with communist magazines, that would be the end of it for him. I don't think that was true when I was talking to him, because this was the early 2000s, but he was conscious that this was a slightly dangerous history to have had and not something that should be publicized, at least not while he was alive. So.
And a lot of this was published, a lot of these more radical stories were published, I guess, in magazines as small features of magazines written for adults.
That's the case for some. I mean, in our anthology, we have work that was published, in a socialist magazine or a communist magazine or in Ms. magazine. One of the feminist fairy tales we have was published in Ms. magazine in their Stories for Children section. But we also have plenty of work that was published by mainstream publishers like Vanguard or Random House. So there's a range. There's a range. But it's true. Yes, some of the stories in here had a fairly limited audience. The Pioneer Mother Goose was published in the Young Pioneer magazine, which was read by communist children. Not a big distribution.
We will talk more about Tales for Little Rebels with editor Philip Nell, including X, A Fabulous Child Story. That comes up after the break. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Philip Nell. He's director of the program in children's literature at Kansas State University, and he is editor, along with Julia L. Mickenberg of UT Austin, of Tales for Little Rebels, a collection of radical children's literature. If you want to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You found a lot of authors, a lot of leftist authors, turned to writing for children to sort of escape the glare of McCarthyism at the time, including Langston Hughes.
That's right. And this is something that Julia details in her book, which I highly recommend. It's called Learning from the Left, Children's Literature, the Cold War, and Radical Politics in the United States. It was published a couple of years ago. But yeah, one of the areas that wasn't policed was writing for children, in part because it was mostly women who were doing this work. And so if it's women, you know, if they're writing for children, how dangerous could that be? So, I mean, I think in some senses the sexism of the censors made the children's literature field one that was safe for folks on the left. And so a lot of people on the left, including Langston Hughes, including Crockett Johnson, and a number of others, found work writing for children in the 1950s when they were being watched by the FBI. One of my favorite stories that Julia has in her earlier book is the children's editor, Ursula Nordstrom, who's a great editor was a great editor at what was then Harper and Brothers, edited, you know, all the famous authors over there from, you know, Maurice Sendak and Louise Fitzhugh and, well, Crockett Johnson, as I mentioned before. But one of her editors, one of Ursula's authors was worried because her husband was a teacher at the Jefferson School, which was a Marxist school, and she was worried that this was going to come out. Her husband's sympathies would come out, and Harper would get in trouble. And so she told Ursula this, and Ursula said, "I don't care as long as he's not a Republican." So anyway, the children's editors were also sympathetic. They weren't necessarily leftists, but they were liberals, and they were liberal in that sense of being open-minded and of being receptive to people whose political sympathies might be slightly outside of the mainstream.
And you found leftist authors were even writing little golden books.
Yes, and this is something that Julia could speak to in much greater detail, which she does in her book. But that's true. Timur Gurgley is the illustrator of, if I recall, The Pokey Little Puppy. And he's politically on the left. They're all over the place. They're all over the place. And often in ways that aren't explicitly left. I mean, there's nothing necessarily leftist about the children's books that they wrote or illustrated. What Julia found in her book is that actually in science is one really fascinating place where people who lean left wrote. And you'd think, well, science? Why would that attract them? Well, it attracted them because science would teach you to think objectively. It would teach you to think critically. It would teach you to think dialectically, and therefore, you could see through the sham of capitalism, right? Because you'd be able to think critically. So they saw the kind of critical thinking skills you learn in learning about science as being important to thinking critically about culture and about society as well, which I thought was just a fascinating thing, and not something I would ever have expected until learning about it from Julia.
Surprising emphasis earlier in this century on books that talked about evolution.
Right, which, you know, then as now, is something that certainly pulls, conservative Christians or catches conservative Christians' attention. But, you know, science was seen also as a way of making a more progressive society because we would be making our decisions based on evidence and based on reason rather than based on ideology, which I know sounds funny coming from left-leaning writers. But also science was seen as a way to, for example, combat racism. The story In Henry's Backyard, The Races of Mankind, shows us how scientifically we're all part of the same human race. And that was published after the Second World War when anti-racism was making a resurgence, really, in children's literature in that post-war moment. So, yeah, I mean, science has a lot of left-leaning uses that you might not necessarily associate with it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Philip Nell is my guest. He's an editor of Tales for Little Rebels, a collection of radical children's literature. I started college in the late 1980s, and I remember a professor handing us a copy of of X, A Fabulous Children's Story.
No kidding.
Yes, and there was, I suppose, some irony there, but the overall point, and this was a very sort of feminist professor, was that we were all very much shaped by our environments.
I'm really fascinated that you got a copy of that in college. I mean, it was put in an anthology, but it was originally published in Ms. Magazine, and it's really one of my favorite stories, to be honest, in our collection, and I think one of the most radical.
Can you recap it for us before we go on?
Yeah, absolutely. It's about Baby X, and Baby X is part of a secret scientific experiment in which it will not be raised with any reference to its gender. I mean, no reference to its gender. So in terms of the way the parents play with it, what they say to it, the kind of toys they buy, everything has to be gender neutral. So, you know, they buy toys that people might see as more appropriate for little girls, as well as ones they might see as more appropriate for little boys. And the thesis of the story is essentially that to be raised without any expectations based on gender, to be raised gender-free, is the healthiest way to grow up. And it's a really fascinating story. But that's the message of it, and an intriguing story.
I'll confess that I was sort of influenced by that idea. I certainly never planned to execute it, but until I gave birth and realized that they really do sort of come pre-wired.
Well, you know, and the other thing that makes this story sort of utopian is there's no way to block out culture. There's no way to block out the society in which you live. You know, your child will go to school, as X does in this story, or will watch television, or will meet other children. There's really no way to prevent the influence of the world in which the kid grows up in. So, you know, if you could create such a situation like that, it would be one thing, but it's impossible. It's absolutely impossible.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Kenneth in Fort Worth. Hello, Kenneth.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hey, I'm a first-time caller, and
welcome.
I really don't know if this has anything to do with what y'all are talking about, but I have heard that the Wizard of Oz, and I guess that was a children's book, correct?
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if that had anything to do with going off the gold standard.
Ah, yes, that story. Yeah, L. Frank Baum's The Wizard of Oz, published in 1900. He was certainly on the left. His wife was an ardent supporter of women's suffrage. But the gold standard argument comes back to a high school history teacher named, I think his last name was Littlefield, who in the early 1960s published an article with the thesis that you mentioned, that The Wizard of Oz was secretly about getting us off the gold standard. It wasn't about that at all, but it was a useful way for him to teach his students about that particular political issue, which was indeed going on at the time the book was published. So the book isn't about that, but that's a way that it's been read because of this article, as I say, written by this high school history teacher who was trying to find a creative way to teach his students history.
Baum wrote a whole series of really interesting, very fanciful books that unfortunately have been forgotten because of the movie.
Yes. Yes, he did. Well, I mean, there's a whole, I think it's 14 Wizard of Oz books that he wrote. And they're actually pretty interesting books. I mean, in one of them, is it the second or the third in the series? The character who throughout the book you think is a boy is actually a girl, we learn at the end, who has been, you know, bewitched to seem as if she's a boy, which is fascinating in terms of thinking about gender as something that is created by society and is in fact not, you know, fixed. It's not tied to biology. Baum definitely had some progressive ideas, and they do show up in his fiction, and as well as some that aren't so progressive. But he's a fascinating character.
Another thing that I know you know a little bit about, is it reasonable to call Baum the J.K. Rowling of his day?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. L. Frank Baum was enormously popular. His work was adapted for film even early on, well before the 1939 MGM film. It was, you know, they were bestsellers. He was nationally known in his life. So yeah, he was another pop culture phenomenon as well as children's author, just as Rowling is today. And you know, I mean, he continues to be. There continue to be Oz-inspired work out there Wicked being perhaps the most prominent example today, the novel, but of course also the musical.
Philip Nell is my guest. He's an editor of Tales for Little Rebels, a collection of radical children's literature. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. There have been some fake leftist works for children created, in part, I guess, to try and discredit those who diverged from the mainstream. There was a Black Panther coloring book.
Right, the Black Panther coloring book, the Contle Pro item. Yeah, that was put together by the FBI, I recall, in order to discredit the Black Panthers. So it was allegedly authored by the Black Panthers and putting revolutionary thoughts into children's heads through a coloring book. But in fact, it was just government propaganda designed to discredit them, which is fascinating in its own right and a subgenre worthy of further study.
It seems hard to believe that government resources would be put towards something like this.
We've just lived through 8 years of an interesting use of many government resources. So actually, I don't find it at all hard to believe. I wish I did find it hard to believe. So, but yeah, it's certainly a questionable use of one's taxpayer money.
How often, Philip, have these radical books been able to find their way into standard children's libraries in schools?
Well, I think it depends largely upon the distribution. So, you know, I had a student in my class. I guess I had a whole class on radical children's literature this past semester. But a student who had read Oscar the Ostrich, which is a book published in 1940, and it is about ostriches getting their heads out of the sand and uniting to take a stand against fascism. So it's about organizing and fighting against the powerful dictator. And she read this. This was in her school. Now, it was published by Vanguard. It had a major press behind it. Or books like Girls Can Be Anything, which was published in 1973, was written by Norma Klein. You know, that also had a wide distribution. So I think it really depends upon who's publishing it as far as where it gets to. You know, the Socialist Primer, I don't think was read by a lot of people. That had a very, you know, very, very small distribution, mainly socialists. So it all depends upon the means of distribution, really.
Let's talk for a minute about Norma Klein. She continues, years after her death, to have a book or two on the ALA's most banned list.
Right. Well, that's because she also wrote for young adults. And in fact, that's what she's best known for, is her fiction for young adults. Mom, the Wolfman, and Me is the one that I remember first hearing of. This was one of her first books, Girls Can Be Anything. And she wrote it, I think, shortly after becoming a parent. And certainly the thesis is right there in the title. Marina,
she had two daughters, right?
She has two daughters, yeah, one of whom actually became an English professor. I think that her daughters learned that they can't be anything. But the main character of the book we've included here, her friend Adam is telling her all the things that girls can't do. But she learns, in fact, that girls can be doctors, and they can be pilots, and even president of the United States. That's the message of the book, and I don't know what else to add about that.
Let's talk about some of the ways that radical writers have taken on ecological topics. I think the most interesting example of this, beyond the Lorax and some of the Seuss works, was the day they parachuted cats into Borneo.
Yeah, that's a favorite of mine, too. I like that one a lot.
The illustrations are great.
Yeah, Jose Arruego has a long career of illustrating books for children, and it's a very funny story, and it's told in verse, and it's about the disastrous consequences of messing with the environment. You know, how if you make one small change, it has catastrophic long-term effects. So the author of the book, Charlotte Pomerantz, wrote an article in 1969 about the World Health Organization use of DDT in Borneo. And so the idea is that they spray this insecticide and it kills malaria-carrying mosquitoes, which is a good idea, right? Except that small change in the ecosystem produced all kinds of consequences they had not foreseen, such as the killing of animals that eat those mosquitoes, like cockroaches, and then killing of animals who eat those, right up to killing the cats. And so Borneo gets overrun by rats, and they have to parachute cats in to take care of the rats. And so it's a comic story in some senses, but it's also, you know, shows how catastrophic messing with the environment can be.
Yeah, it's almost like the woman who swallowed the fly. It just builds up.
Exactly.
And builds up.
Exactly. That's the perfect comparison. That's that kind of narrative where it sort of one event leads to another event, leads to another event, and it becomes more and more crazy and ridiculous. Except this is actually a true story, and they did actually have to parachute cats on Borneo to try to solve the problem that, you know, was caused by a well-intentioned idea, right? You want to prevent the spread of malaria, except not having thought it through, you also prevent a lot of creatures from surviving. So, yeah.
We've talked about this just slightly this hour, but race is something that radical writers have really focused on in the 20th century. And you all point out in the book that up through the 1950s and 60s, most books, if they featured African-American characters at all, they were in subservient roles.
Yeah, that's true. And there was a famous article published in the mid-60s called The All-White World of Children's Literature by Nancy Larrick, and that really called attention to this issue. There are sort of, well, I guess I'd say there are three moments in the 20th century where race comes to the fore in children's literature. The first would be the Harlem Renaissance. Some of Langston Hughes' first works were, in fact, for children. And that's one moment where we get that happening. He and Arnabon Tops in the 1930s and also in the 1920s. And the next moment is, as I mentioned before, right after the Second World War. And you get books like North Star Shining, which we've included in here, which is actually by two white authors, but is an heroic portrayal of notable African-Americans in history, either ones who became famous or ones who did not. And then the next moment is connected to that Nancy Larrick article and connected to the 1960s in particular and the Civil Rights Movement. The book The Snowy Day by Ezra Jack Keats,
yeah,
also a white author, is really one of the most important early works in this regard because it presents a black child as perfectly ordinary, playing in the snow, doing the kinds of things that you'd expect any child to do, and that really ushers in a wave of black authors and white authors with positively represented African-American authors.
Yeah, he's just
children,
a kid, as opposed to this being a story about his race specifically.
Yeah, and that was Keats's way of getting this across, is normalizing it, making him ordinary, not making him unusual. And of course, there are plenty of books by and about African Americans that do take race as central. The Black BCs by Lucille Clifton, the poet and National Book Award winner, is an Afrocentric ABC book, and so that is about race and it is for children. But you know, there are different ways of making this argument of equality, and those are two different ones.
Back in just a minute with Philip Nell, editor of Tales for Little Rebels, a collection of radical children's literature.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Philip Nell. He is director of the program in children's literature at Kansas State University and co-author, along with Julia L. Mickenberg, of Tales for Little Rebels, a collection of radical children's literature. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. Wanted to switch the focus to some of the things that are being written these days. I was really fascinated to find, and it makes perfect sense, I suppose, that you consider a book people may know called Click Clack Moo to be somewhat radical.
Well, yeah, and there is certainly reason to debate that one, but it is about organizing the cows and the chickens organize.
They want electric blankets.
They want electric blankets because it's cold. And they have a typewriter, and they present their demands through Duck, who is labeled as a neutral party, who delivers the demands to Farmer Brown. And if Farmer Brown won't give them electric blankets, then there'll be no milk. There'll be no eggs. And they win their demands. And so one way to read it is as being about the power of organizing, about the power of banding together and fighting for your rights as an oppressed group. However, it can also be seen as a joke, because their demands are silly. And at the end of the story, they give away their typewriter. The duck takes the typewriter, and that's part of the settlement that they reach. So they have made gains, but they've also given up their voice. So, you know, some of these books that we have listed here, it's there. As is the case with all works of literature, interpretation is involved, and people will arrive at different meanings for them. And so you may see them as more or less radical.
I wonder wonder if it's been a challenge in your career in academia, Philip, to have focused on children's literature. There have to be some colleagues who are ready to dismiss all children's literature as something that's written just for entertainment and isn't necessarily some of the best writing in the world.
That's true. I mean, there has been a sense among some academics, at least, that children's literature is not really literature with a capital L.
I have to say, I disagree with that, by the way.
And so do I. And I suppose that won't surprise you, given the field that I've chosen. Mm-hmm. There is that prejudice out there. I mean, I think it has diminished in the last 35 years or so with the increasing influence of women's studies, of cultural studies, of movements within academia that ask us to take seriously popular culture, that ask us to take seriously work by women, or work produced in a field dominated by women, such as children's literature, and I think that's helped a lot. But there are certainly still people who don't think of children's literature as literature, who are, you know, quite otherwise intelligent people. Harold Bloom's comments on the Harry Potter series come to mind. You know, an extraordinarily prolific critic, one of the best read professors in the world, but who considers them basically second-rate trash.
Do you think most parents are paying closer attention these days to what their children are reading than in, say, the 70s?
I think there's a greater focus on what children do by parents in general since the 70s. You know, you mentioned that you went to college in the late 80s, and so did I. I had a much less regulated childhood than it seems that children have today.
Indeed, yeah.
So, I think that's a fair claim. That's a fair claim.
So does that make it harder, do you think, for radical writers to sort of get this in front of their child audiences, or do you think parents are more likely to seek it out if they want their kids reading this?
Well, I mean, certainly like-minded parents who are sympathetic to the causes of the story will seek these out. So that will help. As to whether it's more difficult or less difficult for these works to find an audience, that's a tricky one. I mean, in some senses, the market has changed since then, and children will have other ways of learning about what's out there beyond their parents, beyond the library. There's the Internet, for example. And then in other senses, libraries have become a place where free speech is important, and free speech is something to be protected. And so libraries bring in books of all kinds of points of view, and this has really become the mission of the American Library Association, or one of their most prominent missions. That's why they host Banned Books Week every year, where they explicitly highlight books that have been challenged or banned in various schools and libraries around the country. So, you know, in that sense, I think the public library is still a place where children can go and be exposed to ideas that, you know, may not be their own or may not be their parents'.
I wonder if you've compared the influence of cinema on kids today. I remember when the movie WALL-E came out, there was a lot of talk about this message of environmentalism that some people felt went too far and some people were delighted with.
You know, I haven't thought a great deal about cinema, but I know that the Happy Feet film was attacked by some on the right as being, you know, too pro an ecological agenda because it starred penguins. So I know that this is in the minds certainly of parents and of people who are concerned about children and what they watch.
They're not even real penguins, for crying out loud.
I know, but apparently this was enough. It's funny about efforts to protect children because on the one hand, one wants to praise that. You know, you don't want to hurt children, and indeed, efforts to protect children is why we have childhood at all. I mean, this is really something that, at least in the West, is a 19th century invention, the idea that children should have a childhood. So, you know, on the one hand, you know, I have to be sympathetic with people who are concerned about what their kids are watching and kids are reading. But then on the other hand, are you doing kids a service by preventing them or trying to prevent them from learning things? I mean, wouldn't it be more productive to help them cope with some of the tricky and dangerous realities that they may face? I mean, wouldn't you rather guide them through that rather than just ban them from seeing it? So it's, you know, I can see both sides of the issue. I can see both sides of the issue, and I honor the impulse in both ways, even if, you know, I would tend more to want to help the child deal with it rather than prevent their knowledge. But anyway.
Let's go next to Larry in Dallas. Hi, Larry.
This is Larry from Hi. Dallas. You hear me okay?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I have a short question for you. I'd like to preface it with a quick my definition of things like liberal and radical and so on, okay?
Okay. Sure.
I've always felt like, since being very young, that society is well served by liberalism or liberal people as defined by people open to other ideas,
mm-hmm.
willing to think and talk about questioning most anything, so on and so forth. That's my definition of liberal, not what I hear on television. That being said and done,
mm-hmm.
I would define radicals as far left, far right, unwilling to meet in the middle. So my question is, do you agree with my definition of radicalism? And if not, how do you define it? Because I'm a little upset with the concept of radical children's
uh-huh.
books. I'll take my answer offline, okay?
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, that's a fair question, and I think the distinction that you make is a good one. A liberal is something who's going to be open-minded and also arguing for a kind of more gradual sense of change, a progressive sense of change, if you will, whereas someone who's radical really seeks change at the roots of it and much more fundamental and far-reaching change. And as I mentioned at the top of the hour, our own book is not full of radical children's literature, despite its subtitle. It has some definitely radical children's literature that is calling for the kind of far-reaching, even revolutionary change. But it really spans from, you know, radical at the most extreme to liberal at the most mild. So I guess my sense is, you mentioned you were disturbed with the idea of a collection of radical children's literature. It's not a collection of radical children's literature. It's a collection of children's literature that is left-leaning and spans from liberal to radical.
Let's go next to Roseanne in Dallas. Hey, Roseanne.
Hello. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if your guest was familiar with a book that is a seasonal book called The Country Bunny and the Little Gold Shoes. It was published in the 50s or 60s, and I consider it one of my favorite feminist fables.
You know, I've read it. But it's been a long time since I've read the book, and I think it was actually published earlier than that. I wish I had something intelligent to say about it, but it's been a long time. Do you want to say something about why it's one of your favorite
Absolutely.
Feminist fables?
It is one of my favorite feminist fables, and one that I will read when I do readings for children. It is about a little girl brown-tailed rabbit who mm-hmm. expressed an interest to becoming one of the five Easter bunnies. Mm-hmm. And she is laughed at by all of the male bunnies, such as the jackrabbits and so forth. She
right.
stops out, raises 21 bunnies, teaches them how to run her household, and then she goes off and becomes one of the five Easter bunnies.
Right.
And the most special one of all.
Right. And it's by Du Bois Hayward, right? The librettist for Porgy and Bess.
That is right. Anyway,
yeah.
A delightful book.
Sounds
yeah,
great.
It is.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Roseanne.
All right.
Thank you.
It's always great to have something else to go track down. I wonder if that's still in print.
It is still in print.
It is.
You also find it in any public library. I haven't read it or thought about it in a long time. So.
We have an email from Kelly in Dallas who wants to know what you think about Madeleine L'Engle's Wrinkle in Time series.
Oh, Madeleine L'Engle's Wrinkle in Time series. Let's see. What do I think about those? I mean, my own sort of thumbnail sketch of them, having not read them recently, is that they're Cold War fantasy, and that what the children struggle against seems to be an allegory for totalitarianism, specifically totalitarian communism. I mean, that's, again, not a book I've taught recently, but that seems to be the explicit allegory that L'Engle is putting forth, especially in A Wrinkle in Time.
It must be fascinating to work with, I don't know how often you teach undergrads, but young students who have recently read these for the first time, you know, maybe
yeah.
within the past decade.
Mm-hmm.
Do they tend to bring different perspective every couple of years on what these books mean?
They do, and, you know, what's, I think, especially interesting for them is revisiting something that they had long cherished, that was part of their childhood, and that they have a particular emotional attachment to and an investment in, and then thinking about it critically. Some of them resist that. You know, some of them don't want to do that. Others are interested by it. Others are interested that, you know, as you grow up and you learn more things about the world, that your interpretation of a work will change and will differ. And they're quite, you know, they're quite happy to have their mind change and their opinions change about things. We had this discussion certainly about Curious George which I taught in my Radical Children's Lit class this semester, there's a reading of the book that it's really an imperialist book, you know, that it's a book that sort of normalizes imperialism because, you know, George becomes this colonized character who is taken out of the jungle and is actually, you know, does okay in this this white world. And, you know, of course, that's upsetting to people who have read Curious George as a child and who identify with his sort of sense of mischief. And it may also not be, it's also not the only way to read the book either. The Rays, who wrote Curious George, were actually quite liberal and were in favor of integration. And one of the ways they put that into their Curious George books is that if you look in the crowd scenes in any Curious George book, you'll see an integrated crowd. You'll see black children and white children side by side. It's a subtle message, but it's there. So anyway, that's an example, certainly, of kids coming back to a book as a grown-up and then saying, hey, I had no idea these political issues were being raised about it.
Do you have kids yourself or often have occasion to read to actual children?
No, my wife and I don't have children. I do spend time with children now and then, actual children, as you put it,
well,
as opposed to say fake children.
Yeah, I'm wondering if it's challenging, you know, to look, knowing what you know and having looked at all these books as closely as you have, if it's possible for you to sort of just pick up a book because the pictures are great and the text is pleasing.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, and I think there are many ways to appreciate a book. We've been talking about the political dimensions of a book, but the pleasure of the illustrations, the pleasure of the story, the pleasure of the familiar, a retelling, say, of a familiar fairy tale, or of being surprised by something innovative that you hadn't expected to find in a book. Now, there are many, many pleasures of children's literature, and certainly thinking about politics is one of those, but there are many, and you know, as far as children are concerned, I think for them, what's best is to allow them to experience the literature in their own way, but there are many ways for them to read. People like to generalize about children and say children like X, right? Children are going to like this book or this movie. You never hear them say that about adults. You never hear, grown-ups will love this, right? We're comfortable making assumptions about children, but we shouldn't be because individual children can be as different as individual adults. And so my own wish is that children be allowed to choose books that interest them and ignore the books that don't and, you know, discover the pleasures on their own and discover their own pleasures in the works.
Who's doing the most interesting writing today for children, do you think?
Oh, goodness. Let me think about that.
And I've given you like 15 seconds to answer, so.
Oh, 15 seconds. Well, that's no problem. Okay, for teenage readers, I think Philip Pullman is brilliant. I think M.T. Anderson is brilliant. Laurie Halse Anderson is doing great works. For younger readers, I'm a big fan of Lane Smith. Always have been a big fan of Lane Smith. Mo Willems is doing wonderful books for children as well. So there's a few off the top of my head. I hope I'm under 15 seconds.
That's great. Thank you so much.
Philip
Nell is co-editor of Tales for Little Rebels, a collection of radical children's literature. It really has been a pleasure, Philip. Thank you so much. My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.